You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 213 by Rudolf Steiner, 13 lectures entitled Human Questions and Cosmic Answers, translated by Elizabeth Marshall. This is the sixth lecture given in Dornach on the 7th of July, 1922. Today I would like to introduce some of what I will be talking about in the next 2 days by linking it to the life and teachings of a personality about whom I have spoken in various lectures and about whom I have written more extensively in the third chapter of my book titled Riddles of the Soul. I will be talking about this personality, Franz Brentano, as one of the representative minds of the second half of the 19th century. The reasons for this will become clear when we continue our studies here. Some observations can also be found in the journal titled The Goetheanum. I particularly want to begin today with his life and teachings, as it is the occasion of the publishing of the first volume from Brentano's legacy, which contains one of the most important chapters of his worldview, namely, on the teachings of Jesus as Franz Brentano understands them. Franz Brentano, the philosopher, died aged 79 in 1917 in Zurich. There came to an end a philosophical life which is undoubtedly one of the most interesting in history, and above all in the second half of the 19th century. Not only was Franz Brentano a teacher of philosophy, in him lived a philosophical personality, a personality whose philosophical aspirations came from the breadth and the depths of his whole being. The philosopher Brentano was a scion of the family to which the German romanticist Clemens Brentano, who was his uncle, belonged. And Clemens Brentano was part of that family which was acquainted with Goethe through Sophie La Roche and through Maximilian Brentano. As a family, they united two schools of thought, which were prevalent at the beginning of the 19th century, and often linked to one another. On the one hand, Catholicism. The Brentano family were good Catholics. And on the other, the Romantics. Clemens Brentano created the most beautiful German Romantic poetry, and reflective of the Romantic atmosphere of German intellectual life, he was an eminent teller of fairy tales. We could say that German fairy tales, as told by the German Romanticists, were transformed, so that a real light shone from the spiritual world onto those who listened to them. And as a small child, our philosopher Franz Brentano listened to these tales told by his uncle Clemens Brentano. Now for us, two things are important here. The one is that Franz Brentano grew up in this spiritual atmosphere. He was born in 1838. In 1842, Clemens Brentano died. The other thing that is important for us is that Franz Brentano, coming from this Catholic Romanticism, grows into the strictest ideas of natural science, which dominated the intellectual life of the new civilization in the second half of the 19th century. Franz Brentano grew up in such a way that piety filled his soul. For him, the religious element is something completely natural in the soul. Catholicism is not something absorbed from outside, but rather an integral part of the soul. The boy Franz Brentano fervently embraces and grows up in Catholic piety. Nurtured through Romanticism, he has awakened in himself a great appreciation of the spiritual. For the Romantic genius such as Clemens Brentano, the spiritual lives more in the form of fantasy, tending not to abide by the rules of logic, but to reach the spiritual world and to dwell there through flights of fantasy. Whereas, with Franz Brentano, this highly developed sense of spiritual life transforms itself into a special talent for developing stringent concepts. To add to this, it was just a matter of course for Franz Brentano, as a Catholic, to immerse himself in philosophical and theological studies. His subtle intellectuality led him to immerse himself early on in the thoughts of Aristotle, and then in the strict schooling of the medieval scholastics. As I have already explained in more detail, Aristotelianism lives on in medieval scholasticism, and we could say that while Franz Brentano retained his highly developed sense of the spiritual, he was not able to disregard the logical faculties of the human soul, as did Clemens Brentano, but developed the most stringent logic through which he was then able to form his ideas. However, as significant as his skill at logical thinking was, the genuinely Catholic piety of his early youth was more important for his theological and philosophical development. There is something quite unique about a modern scholastic education, such as Franz Brentano underwent as a result of his Catholicism. We have to emphasize that a really strict logic, not that fleeting, superficial logic taught in schools today and prevalent in natural science, but a really stringent logic connected with the whole person and not just with the human head, this developed out of scholasticism. Scholasticism is, to the highest degree, the art of the logical development of ideas. However, this scholasticism was used in the Middle Ages and in Catholicism until today to support the Catholic doctrine of revelation, as I have discussed in my lectures on Thomism. In the case of Franz Brentano, there developed a specific intellectuality from his Catholic piety and from his strict schooling in scholasticism. He developed the faculty of seeing the existence of a spiritual world as completely self-evident. Being on intimate terms with both Catholicism and scholastic theology, he lived in spirituality and was unable not to do so. And he understood spirituality by means of the strictest logic. He was actually a true Catholic. He was such a true Catholic in the strictest sense that despite the fact that he had developed the strictest logic, he would never have allowed himself to criticize the Catholic doctrine of revelation, at least up until a certain point in his life. Now, I ask you to imagine a person in all their human profundity, someone who lives in the most stringent logic, and who has heard the most derogatory criticisms of the Catholic doctrine of revelation from many a modern thinker. This would cause him the most terrible doubts, all of which he has thrust down into the unconscious, none of which he allows to become conscious. As soon as they surface into consciousness, he represses them. He says to himself, "The Catholic doctrine of revelation is a closed system," and shows clearly that it has come down to earth from the spiritual worlds through human beings, even if in many a roundabout way. It reveals its own truth, and when there are doubts, we must always assume that as a single person we can always be mistaken in the face of an all-encompassing system of such venerable greatness as Catholicism. Since this is one of the doctrines of Catholicism, and only the synods can ever speak about the dogmas, when those doubts about the doctrine of revelation emerged from his unconscious, Franz Brentano would never have allowed himself to take them seriously. He repressed them all and told himself that it is impossible to accept such doubts. But those terrible doubts churned about in his feelings, in his sensations, in the unconscious regions of his soul. He did not do as did the thinkers of the Enlightenment of the 18th and 19th centuries and accept these doubts, but rather he repressed them again and again as being forbidden. Then something happened that caused a great turnaround in his soul. Brentano was born in 1838. In the 1860s, he was ordained as a Catholic priest, the state of his soul as I have described above, and became professor of philosophy at the university in Würzburg. There he was confronted with the movement for the dogma of infallibility, which developed toward the end of the 1860s. This dogma was meant to be declared in 1870. As an excellent theologian and a pious Catholic, at the time he was relatively young, Franz Brentano was given the task of saying what there was to be said on this subject from the point of view of Catholic theology by the famous Bishop Kettler. Now I will just describe the external sequence of events. Kettler was one of those German bishops who firmly rejected the adoption of the dogma of infallibility. He commissioned a memorandum from Franz Brentano, which the bishop would then read out in the assembly of bishops in Fulda, so as to stipulate that the German bishops would not support the doctrine of infallibility. Kettler did read out the full text of Brentano's memorandum against the doctrine of infallibility at the assembly of bishops in Fulda. This is what happened externally. And we have to add that the German bishops later retracted their decision when they were assembled in Rome and the doctrine of infallibility was about to be declared. They backed down and voted for the doctrine of infallibility. So Franz Brentano had criticized this dogma for Bishop Kettler as being not Catholic. And then the doctrine of infallibility was declared. Where did this leave Franz Brentano as a distinguished theologian and as a devout Catholic? He would never have allowed himself to criticize a dogma that he had inherited. However, when Bishop Kettler called upon him to criticize the doctrine of infallibility, it was not yet dogma, but on its way to becoming one. In this case, he took the liberty of attacking the dogma intellectually. This was exactly what Bishop Kettler, who was also at first against the dogma of infallibility, had wanted. From his own perspective at that time, the end of the 1860s, Franz Brentano would never have challenged an established dogma, but infallibility was not yet a dogma, and so he criticized it with all his usual brilliance. And Kettler presented Brentano's memorandum at the Conference of Bishops in Fulda. Now infallibility had become legitimate Catholic dogma. You see, the crucial turning point for Franz Brentano was not only rational considerations, but rather this course of events connected to one of the most important decisions in modern Catholicism. Perhaps it would never have happened from a mere intellectual aspect, but his turning away from the Church took place as a result of these events. He was the most important critic of the dogma of infallibility, and so he had to ask himself whether, as the devout Christian Franz Brentano, who had criticized the dogma of infallibility from the depths of his Catholic conscience before the year 1870, was still a Catholic after infallibility had formally become dogma. So you see here that events have played a larger part in a person's life than any worthless intellectual decision usually can. And so it came about that a person with such an upright and spirited conscience as Franz Brentano had no choice but to leave the Church. We only have to look at this whole course of events to see how deeply Franz Brentano was connected to a particular aspect of the intellectual life of the second half of the 19th century. Now, Franz Brentano was a philosopher who had abandoned a Catholic career. He also had a completely different education from that of the other philosophers of the 19th century. Among non-ecclesiastical philosophers, his education did not count for much. However, he had now joined the ranks of these non-ecclesiastical philosophers. At the same time, the scientific way of thinking of the 19th century had made a great impression on him. Since the beginning of the 19th century, this scientific way of thinking had set the tone for the whole of scientific life, and Franz Brentano had qualified as a professor in Würzburg with a thesis entitled "The True Method of Philosophy is None Other Than That of the Natural Sciences." The methods of natural science had made such an impression on him that he could only say that if it is to be a real science, philosophy has to use the same methods as does natural science. It really is not easy to unravel the soul knot into which Franz Brentano had become entangled in the 1860s. Let us look quite objectively at what the situation was. A human being who was perhaps the most knowledgeable expert of his times on Thomism and Aristotelianism, on the one hand an incredibly keen thinker and conceptualizer, but all from the point of view of Catholicism, and on the other hand, someone greatly impressed by the methods of natural science. How is this possible? But it is possible if you look at it as follows. First, take medieval scholasticism. It is an intellectual science based on scholastic concepts. A science which, however, confined itself to knowledge of the external world of the senses, and to some findings gained through insights from the sense world, whereas the supersensible was to be left to revelations, into which field intellectual knowledge should not stray. Thus medieval scholasticism strictly differentiates between the field of sensual knowledge, with some implications, as for example the existence of God or other such inferences, they belong to human knowledge. Then in contrast the actual mysteries, the contents of the spiritual world, which can only be attained through revelation, meaning what the Church has preserved of the revelations of supersensible worlds, which at various times have been revealed to humanity in a way that the Church finds acceptable. This was already the preparation for the modern scientific view. This modern science wants only the knowledge of the senses, and, at most, some inferences arising from this sensual knowledge. Modern science has no idea that it is the continuation of scholasticism, with the exception of a few radical spirits, who have done things slightly differently than the scholastics. Let us epitomize it with a diagram. The scholastics say to themselves, with the intellect and with ordinary science, we can gain knowledge of the ordinary world of the senses, and also of some inferences we can draw from this. Then there is a border beyond which lies the supersensible world, into which we cannot enter. Modern natural science does the same. They say, we can penetrate the sense world with our human knowledge, and we can infer various things resulting from it. The scholastics said, above this there lies the supersensible world, which we can only know through revelation. Radical thinkers of the modern world said, we can only perceive the sense world. We leave out the supersensible one. Either it does not exist, or at least we are not able to perceive it. This is how they became agnostics. What was common practice among the scholastics in relation to knowledge of the sense world, and some inferences resulting from it, then resumes in the modern scientific attitude. So that a mind which has absorbed a scholastic education for the whole of their youth does not need to see in modern scientific methodology anything other than the continuation of the scholastic outlook. And because he was a devout Catholic, for Franz Brentano, the existence of the spiritual world was self-evident. So he was actually more consistent than hundreds upon hundreds of others, both Catholics and non-Catholics. Thus Brentano turned to scientific methodology. The methodology of natural science, however, has either to become aware of its limits, or to declare itself either agnostic, or that the spiritual world does not exist. However, if the existence of the supersensible world is for you self-evident, but you can no longer accept the truth of revelation, because you no longer accept the Church's truths, as was the case with Franz Brentano, then you are in a special position. A superficial mind would easily cope with this. Either they would deny the supersensible world, or they would just ignore it. This was not possible for Franz Brentano. But because of his scholastic training, he could utter the following thesis. The true method of philosophy is none other than that of the natural sciences. Now, as you all know, someone who, despite accepting the methods of natural science, still wants to reach the spiritual world through cognitive means, must advance from ordinary scientific methodology to what I call exact clairvoyance, or exact vision, which we attain by developing supersensible faculties according to the methods I have described in my books. However, Franz Brentano shied away from developing this vision, from developing any kind of cognitive methodology which went beyond that of natural science. The same disposition was at work in him here as in his attitude as a Catholic toward revelation. Science had no place in this revelation. Thus he could understand a scientific method that confined itself to the world of the senses. However, it is precisely when we take this seriously that we should also develop supersensible faculties. He shied away from this. So, in this mood, Franz Brentano became a philosopher. No longer a theologizing one, just a simple philosopher. We could say that such a personality, one who experiences deeply all the storms and struggles to be found in the intellectual life of those times, and who is not victorious in their own soul, such a personality is often much more significant and much more interesting than others, who cope with all possible difficulties more easily and with more superficial ideas. Now, in this soul mood, Franz Brentano was summoned to Vienna, to that Austria about which I have spoken here recently. And I have described his special intellectuality, so that if you keep that in mind, you will be able to understand how such a philosopher could make such a great impression in Vienna. Brentano did this. Even in his outward appearance, he was an extremely interesting person. He had a highly intellectual head. His eyes sparkled with intelligence, which probably reflected something of the eyes of the romanticist Clemens Brentano. Franz Brentano was a striking personality, so that when people saw him walking toward the podium, the lectern, he always gave the impression of not having completely descended into his physical body. Almost every movement, walking, the gestures of the arms, the facial expressions, the forming of words, there was something unnatural about it all. You always had the feeling something is moving this physical body about as you would move a piece of clothing. And still he made the most congenial and intelligent impression. You could not resist the feeling that for this personality, with the serious tone of voice, the constant striving to form the most stringent of ideas, who gave the impression of not inhabiting his head with his thinking, but of floating slightly above it, that for this person it was quite natural to wear the physical body like a suit of clothes that fits badly, that is too large or too small, perhaps too large. And some gestures that in another person would seem provocative were, in Franz Brentano, interesting. Franz Brentano was at pains to emphasize the methods of natural science. When he dealt with intellectual problems, he did so with a mentality learned from natural science. However, I have to say the theologian still existed in his way of speaking. It was an enormous difference to hear scientific methodology spoken about by an ordinary researcher or by this philosopher who came from theology. For those who have an idea of Franz Brentano, it seems quite natural that when he came to Vienna in 1874, he became the darling of Viennese society, meaning a society which particularly loved a figure such as Franz Brentano was at the time, especially the women. In the 1870s, the men of this society were less interested in culture, had a taste for Franz Brentano. He always had something witty to say. He was intellectually superior, but at the same time not, you sometimes felt, superior to him. When he arrived, he took off his coat in a clumsy manner. People would help him and so feel superior to him in certain respects, where he needed help, for example, when someone supported him to prevent him tripping over the doorstep, and so on. Or he failed to find his spoon, or he sawed at his meat from one side to the other so that it ceased to be a piece and became what in some areas of Germany is called a slop. So you could feel superior to him at the same time as the light of the spiritual world shone through him. Then Adolf Wilbrandt, a writer, who was sometimes very ingenious, but not particularly sensitive to the depths of the human soul, tried to lampoon him in his title Guest of the Evening Star. In Vienna, this novella was seen as ridiculing Franz Brentano, but in reality it does so only in the sense that I have described above. When Franz Brentano gave a lecture in Vienna, in this soul mood, he attracted what were for the time large audiences. You have to remember that then, philosophy was not a very prestigious field. Franz Brentano had already had large audiences when he was an associate professor in Würzburg. This was in the same lecture theater where students had hung a sign on the door reading "Den of Brimstone," after the first lecture of his predecessor. They boycotted the rest of his course. In this same lecture theater, Franz Brentano lectured on philosophy and attracted more and more listeners. It was the same in Vienna. Whenever he gave a lecture there, the hall was full. Now, one of his first writings was his title, Psychology. His intent was to write a psychology with scientific methods. He reckoned with 4 or 5 volumes. In the spring of 1874, the first volume was published. He promised a second for the autumn, and it was supposed to continue in this manner. He approached the subject with the most stringent scientific methods, and just as we can imagine how a metal heats up or cools down, or whether the heat from one metal is transferred to another metal, he wanted to examine how one idea follows from another, how the one idea correlates with another, in short, all the smaller conditions of the life of the soul. He got no further than that. But he said in the first volume, "We must have a science for the study of the mind, for psychology." However, if we have to trade off this scientific approach for the fact that a modern study of the mind has nothing to say about what happens to the higher entity of the human being when the body is consigned to the earth elements, then we would have sacrificed something too valuable. For Brentano, who lived so naturally in the mind that he could not, of course, verify with scientific methods, this mind was not something he was prepared to ignore as a subject of cognitive inquiry. He certainly wanted to access the spiritual world cognitively, but he also wanted to remain within the confines of natural science. Therefore, the first volume of Brentano's title, Psychology, was also the last. He was too conscientious and true to science to be able to continue writing as a formality. Obviously, he could easily have done that and produced a psychology, just like all the others. But if Brentano was to continue writing a psychology, then every page would have to be true, as was the case with the first volume, within the limits of those truths a human being can attain. However, Franz Brentano wanted to remain scientific. This did not allow for extending into the field of the mind-soul, but just to deny it, as did those psychologists who wrote a study of the soul without the soul, this he could not do. He could only keep silent. And so he never wrote a second volume, nor any further ones. Followers of Brentano have resented the fact that I put forward this argument in the third chapter of my book titled Riddles of the Soul. This is because they tend to explain all this much more superficially. However, even if we did decide to say that Brentano's followers knew better, either from his legacy or because they were close to him, the first volume of his writings to appear after his death, which was published in excellent form by Brentano's student Alfred Castile, who also wrote the introduction, shows Brentano in the same soul mood which prevented him from writing a second volume of Psychology to follow the first. The first chapter of this first posthumous volume contains, quote, "The Moral Teaching of Jesus According to the Gospels," close quote, which was written after he left the church, long after he left the church. He would accept nothing that was not in accordance with the strictest ethos of natural science. The second chapter is, quote, "The teaching of Jesus on God and the world and his own person and mission according to the Gospels," close quote. The third chapter is particularly detailed and is a critique of Pascal's title Apology for the Christian Religion. After a short passage on Nietzsche as an imitator of Jesus, there follows in the appendix, quote, "A brief description of the Christian doctrine," close quote. After all that has been written in the 19th century about Jesus and his teachings, from all possible points of view, orthodox, semi-orthodox, free church, free spirit, even completely atheistic, with reference to all manner of mythology, such as that of David Friedrich Strauss, It is very moving to have before you this book about the teachings of Jesus by Franz Brentano. It is moving to see how this distinguished philosopher, who had left the church, characterizes the moral teachings of Jesus and their enduring significance, followed by the teachings of Jesus on God, the world, and Jesus' own mission. Then the whole significance of the doctrines of the church and the administration of the church, the significance of the church as described by Pascal in his title Apology. All this based exclusively upon the teachings of the Gospels themselves. It is moving to see how clearly Franz Brentano here shows himself as an astute opponent of Pascal, and how he speaks out against Catholicism. It is moving because here is the young Brentano, in all his devoutness and all his great ability to immerse himself in the spiritual, but still a man of the strictest scientific mentality, devoted to the methodology of natural science, someone whose thinking was profound and thus unimpressed by so-called modernism, which is shallow even in its Catholic version. So even though he had left the church, he had never spoken approvingly of modernism. In the 19th century, the question, in the truest sense of the word, arose for those who believed their thinking was firmly based on the principles of natural science, such as David Friedrich Strauss, as to whether they were still Christians. Do you still believe in God? David Friedrich Strauss and many others put these two questions to themselves and answered in the negative. They just did not have the depth of education that Brentano had. Their intellectual life was therefore less tragic. They did not have to struggle with the methods of natural science, since out of a certain shallowness they were able to accept it more easily than could Franz Brentano, who had the greatest difficulties because of his profundity. Still, he saw scientific methodology as a necessity of the times. I am telling you all this because I think that when we look at the facts of his life, both internal and external, through the example of this personality, you will get a better idea of the way civilization was moving in the second half of the 19th century than if I just describe it in the abstract. Franz Brentano's soul mood is such that when we look at him first as a psychologist, we have to say that all his talents tend toward the development of supersensible perception, so as to be able to study the soul. If Brentano had wanted to write another volume of his psychology, then he would have had to develop imaginative cognition, then inspirative cognition, and so on. But he did not want this. As a consequence of not wanting this, he conscientiously refrained from writing a second and third volume. So in a certain sense, he was a casualty of scientific methodology, an honest and conscientious casualty. And just as only supersensible perception, in the sense that I have described in my book titled How to Know Higher Worlds, can reach into the actual being of the soul, so only such a supersensible perception of natural science can penetrate into the all-powerful workings of the spiritual world. A purely scientific astronomy only recognizes the heavenly bodies as they float about in space. At most, with the help of spectral analysis, they analyze the nature of the light of these heavenly bodies. But to them, these are all just globes floating in space. This is all without spirit. And the subject matter of zoology, of biology, of botany, of mineral lore, all without spirit. By virtue of its methodology, natural science has to take account only of the spiritless and to discount the spirit. Spiritual science, in the sense of anthroposophy, must lead us to the spirit again. Supersensible perception leads to the spiritual, not only in psychology, but also in the world at large. So just as with his strictly scientific approach, Brentano was not able to reach the soul being in his psychology, so even after leaving Catholic dogma behind him, he was not really able to reach the mystery of Golgotha. How can we reach the mystery of Golgotha? Only when we are able to realize that the world is permeated by the supersensible spiritual. In this supersensible spiritual, as I have often described, there is a being, the Christ, who lived as the Christ being in the body of Jesus of Nazareth when the mystery of Golgotha took place. Without spiritual science, we would never be able to understand anything further than the personality of Jesus. Only anthroposophical spiritual science can show us how the divine Christ lived in Jesus. But Franz Brentano did not want this. He still retained enough of his Catholic thinking, however, to know the central significance of Jesus for the whole of earthly evolution. This was clear to him. Just as the immortality of the soul was clear to him, even if he could not grasp it cognitively, so was the fact that Jesus is the pivotal point in the development of the earth. But he could not find the transition from Jesus to the Christ. So we see that from the feeling aspect and from the will aspect, he was deeply touched by the significance of the personality of Jesus and by the teachings of Jesus. Take this sentence, for example, quote, "The teachings of Jesus have not been superseded in history," close quote, as David Friedrich Strauss thought, quote, "On the contrary, they have yet to be realized in their fullest sense. Because of human weakness, it will be a hard struggle for us to carry the decisive victory. But because of our inner strength, it will be impossible for us to ever perish. Our conscience will forever bear witness to the truth and to the sacred beauty contained within it, as it has done in pre-Christian times, with the Jews, with pagans, in the Asian Orient, and in the European Occident. So that the moral teachings of Jesus do not signify a great advancement by proclaiming new commandments, but rather by the incomparable example that Jesus gave in his life and in his death, an example which revealed the possibility of such sublime virtue and thus inspired courageous imitation. This example will shine on forever, and no prophecy is more reliable than when we say, 'Jesus forever.'" Close quote. This from the philosopher who had left the church, the distinguished theologian Franz Brentano, who could not advance from Jesus to Christ because of his scientific ethos. Compare these wonderful words about Jesus as the midpoint of the earth's development with much of what theologians who have remained in the church have written, and see what conclusions you arrive at. Also, see what you think about what it means when a personality with such a constitution as the man I described here says the following about Jesus' worldview. Jesus' worldview was not merely geocentric, meaning not centered only on the earth, but Christocentric, in such a way that around this one human individual, Jesus, not only the whole history of the earth, but also that of the spirits, good as well as evil, are organized, and that only through their relationship to him do they find their purpose. We can call the world a monarchy, not just because of the omnipresent God, but also because of the one who was created in his image. Close quote. This is how Franz Brentano approaches the personality of Jesus. But despite the fact that he says of Jesus that his worldview is not just geocentric but Christocentric, that not only the people on the earth but also higher spirits, both good and evil ones, organize themselves around him. Despite all this, he does not move on from the personality of Jesus to the Christ being. So he is in great inner conflict. He asks himself, what about Jesus, the human being, around whom all human history revolves? But Franz Brentano has no ideas which could lead him to the reality of the existence of the Christ in Jesus. Only someone who realizes the reality of the existence of Christ in Jesus can think of making this the pivotal moment of history. Here, too, even though he had managed to reach some conclusion in his writings, published not by him but by his students, even here he has not reached the end of his quest, despite standing, so to speak, at the gates, which he only need open to be able to see the immortality of the soul and the mystery of Golgotha. This is why this slim volume of his, titled The Teaching of Jesus and Its Enduring Significance, is so very interesting, because Franz Brentano had a real vision of this enduring significance. And after having described the teaching of Jesus and its enduring significance in the second chapter, he again asks, are we still Christians? He writes that the answer will depend on the spirit in which the question is asked. And then, after he has blamed modern education for the fact that no real idea of the Christ is possible. He says once again, quote, "Perhaps one could say that the hopes I express here are in vain, because the enormous influence that the teaching and example of Jesus has had on humanity is essentially a result of the fact that people see in him a divine being, and thus embrace a faith to which, according to my understanding, the most progressive of human beings today no longer adhere." Close quote. Here he starts to become rather obtuse. Quote, "However, these people overlook the fact that his influence did not set in with belief in the Godhead of Jesus, but on the contrary, in his example, available to us through the reports of the Gospels, which is one of the most powerful motives leading to the belief in the divinity of his person. There's been nothing like it, nothing we could put beside it in all these centuries and millennia that have passed since then. So that what he gave us remains unique as a beacon for how we live our own lives." Close quote. So you can feel how near Franz Brentano came to the gates of the supersensible world, and how he was held back by the most powerful authority of modern civilization, the methodology of natural science, the ethos of natural science. So after this publication from Brentano's estate, we have to say the same that is to be said about those writings published during his lifetime. Franz Brentano is a thinker of the second half of the 19th century, who was driven in each phase of his soul life to realize the supersensible world, but who could not allow himself this realization of the supersensible world in the face of natural science. Just as earlier on, he had not allowed himself to criticize dogma because of the dogma itself. Thus, exactly through what he was unable to achieve, Franz Brentano stands before us as a shining personality, one of the most significant personalities of the second half of the 19th century. And he teaches us, as do few others, to recognize the intellectual legacy of the 19th century, which has come over into the 20th century, and how it affects human evolution. The end of Lecture 6.